Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. David French of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And, David, we start with kind of where we started yesterday, and that's chaos at the Democratic National Convention. Yesterday, we talked mostly about the WikiLeaks release of the hacked emails from the Democratic National Committee, which uncovered a whole litany of embarrassing secrets. But that was just the tip of the iceberg yesterday. Because at the time we talked, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was still planning to gavel in the convention. That didn't happen after she was roundly booed by her own Florida Democrats at a breakfast. Then there was the issue of Bernie Sanders going before his delegates on Monday. This is before his speech on Monday evening, and encouraging everyone to get behind the Clinton-Kaine ticket. And that didn't exactly go to plan.
We have got to defeat Donald Trump. We have got to elect Hillary Clinton and Tim Kaine.
Ah, that's the sound of unity. And there were also thousands of people protesting in the streets in over 100-degree weather, so I'm sure that smelled great. Meanwhile, during the afternoon, Debbie Wasserman Schultz trying to negotiate the terms of her exile by asking for a plane flight back to Florida, all sorts of other things. The delegates booed the invocation, which should not come as a surprise since they booed God in 2012. Then there was this underlying boo throughout most of the speeches until the final speeches of the evening with Michelle Obama and so forth. But even when Bernie endorsed Hillary in the evening, there was some consternation, and they had some chance for Elizabeth Warren as well. So we'll see if they can keep it up. But there's a lot of disarray going on right now.
Well, yeah. And this is after the Democrats had mocked the Republican convention as being disorganized and in disarray. And then they went ahead and I would say day one of the Republican convention was a model convention compared to day one of the Democratic convention. I mean, the Republicans only dealt with about 30 minutes of a delegate revolt and one little small plagiarism scandal, whereas the Democrats had day-long low-level rebellion amongst the Bernie Sanders crowd, loss of the DNC chair. I mean, it was remarkable, and as is frequently the case, as you pointed out, with the Democrats, a lot of it all came together during, of all the unlikely places, the opening prayer, where people were booing the prayer and chanting Bernie, Bernie, Bernie in the middle of the prayer. I've heard that for many people, politics takes the place of religion, but that's getting a little bit ridiculous.
David, what did you make of the media? I remember, of course, after Ted Cruz refused to endorse Donald Trump, the next morning, even if you couldn't see them on the radio and you could see them on TV, they might as well have had a napkin tucked into their shirt with a knife and a fork in each hand, just ready to love the fact that there's all this friction at the convention. And today you're like, well, it finally got better towards the end when Michelle Obama and Elizabeth Warren and then Bernie spoke. So I think everything's going to be okay now.
You know, I was watching the CNN panel after after Bernie Sanders' speech, and it was really amazing, the universal acclaim from the panelists on the left on how just gracious Bernie was, on how spectacularly he endorsed Hillary Clinton, how he's doing exactly what he needs to do to rally people to get into line. And my wife remarked, "Oh, so this is what it looks like when the media is on your side." It was remarkable, but it still couldn't obscure the fact, and I was struck by this, that it was perhaps one of the most low energy Elizabeth Warren performances that I've ever seen, honestly. She seemed extremely subdued when she's normally a firebrand, and she was constantly being interrupted throughout. And you could tell that when Bernie came out, the enthusiasm for him far exceeded the enthusiasm that you see for Hillary Clinton. The best argument that they were making for Hillary Clinton was she's not Donald Trump. That's the argument that they kept making. It was painfully obvious that in that room, even though it's full of Democratic delegates, there's not a whole lot of love for Hillary Clinton's record, Hillary Clinton's character. There's just a whole lot of hate for Donald Trump.
David, exit question on the first martini. Do you think the Bernie delegates behave Thursday night, or do you think they make a little ruckus?
I think they'll pretty much behave. My own view is, you know, the Democrats are really good at discipline. A lot of people forget that this is not the first time that the first day of the Democratic Convention has seen its disruptions and its protests. I expect that they'll get into line, but you know what? This is 2016, so expect the unexpected. But I'm thinking the Democrats will start to revert to script here pretty soon.
Well, we'll explore that a little bit more in our crazy martini, but on to our bad martini now. And we'd love to have a day where ISIS is not the bad martini for carrying out a horrific and deadly terrorist attack, but sadly, today's not that day. This is from the Daily Mail in the UK. François Hollande, he's of course the French president, says France is at war with ISIS after two Islamist knife men butchered a French priest and left a nun fighting for her life before both terrorists were shot dead by police in Normandy. One of the men who stormed into the church, New Rouen, during Mass was a local man who was being monitored by electronic tag after being jailed for trying to join fanatics in Syria. That should be a clue. The 84-year-old priest named Jacques Hamel had his throat cut while a nun is critically injured in a hospital following the raid, which saw five people held hostage by ISIS assailants shouting Allahu Akbar. So, David, we know from ISIS's actions over the past couple of years that there's nothing that they won't stoop to, and slashing the throat of an 84-year-old priest is certainly among those things. But seeing it in the West is once again causing shock and horror. Credit to President Hollande. He's one of the few leaders in the West who will actually call this what it is. And France is obviously in the middle of a horrific fight against ISIS right now. What do we make of this latest attack?
You know, I tell you, we're reaching the point where there's such regularity now in these attacks. I mean, this is I believe the sixth attack in the last 2 weeks, that it's beginning to look more almost like the kind of intifada that Israel has experienced. We're still a ways away from that, but we're moving from a world where there's this normally peaceful life shattered by dramatic terror, and moving into a world where terror is becoming the new normal, where you're starting to almost see like some sort of low-grade insurgency against the French nation by these terrorists. And that's what happens when you give terrorists safe haven, when you don't take a terrorist threat seriously, and when you allow a critical mass of not just terrorists, but terrorist sympathizers into your country. I mean, this is what happens. And the thing that's so remarkable to me is this is all happening in the aftermath of an environment. Rewind a year ago when the migrant crisis was really emerging into Europe. And the progressive elite in Europe, not only they weren't saying things like, you know, there's probably going to be or there may be some terrorists, terror elements in this community. We know that we're taking risks by dramatically expanding the population. But on balance, given the humanitarian disaster, we think it's the right thing to do and we'll do our best to mitigate the threat. No, they were saying, oh, there's no terror threat. If you think there is a terror threat, you're a bigot, that there's never been terror from refugees. And we're beginning to see not only are you seeing terror from Muslim citizens of countries like France and Germany, but you're also seeing terror from the actual migrant population itself. It's layer upon layer of terror now. And it was very notable and interesting to me that of all the major speeches last night, the Democrats did not mention ISIS one time, not one time, acted as if it didn't exist.
David, I want to get your legal expertise on one thing that I mentioned there and add a couple more details, and that one of the men was being monitored by electronic tag after being jailed for trying to join fanatics in Syria. Goes on to say he had tried to travel to Syria in 2015. His bail terms allowed him to be unsupervised between 8:30 a.m. and 12:30 p.m., and the attack happened between 9 and 11 this morning, French time. So do we give the French credit for at least being clued into this guy? Do we crush them for letting this guy have any sort of unsupervised time of the day? How do we read all this?
Well, you know, I would say, you crushed them for letting him have this unsupervised time. But let's not forget how many American terrorists in America or wannabe terrorists in America have been either interviewed by the FBI or have been on FBI lists. So this is pretty common, in fact, that people who are suspected of terror ties are interviewed by authorities, who are examined by authorities, and then let go and go on to kill. So this is something that's kind of par for the course, but it's also symbolic of how our view of the rule of law is a little different from their view of what constrains them. A plastic bracelet, a monitoring bracelet, is not going to stop a jihadist. And the notion that it would stop a jihadist is just sheer fantasy in law enforcement malpractice.
David, let's go back to the Democratic Convention for our crazy martini and kind of back to the situation involving Bernie Sanders and his supporters. One of the things that we saw with Bernie this year is how much this 74, I think he is now, year-old socialist resonated with the young people, especially on college campuses, which have been rife with safe spaces and trigger warnings and all these other things over the past couple of years, or at least ramping up over the past couple of years. And these people are not used to being told they can't have what they want. And so when Bernie Sanders did not win this nomination, they wanted him to press on. He said last night that the revolution continues, so we're going to ask you to vote for the person I was revolting against, which I don't think sat too well. You had some of these young people in the audience with tape over their mouths, with silenced written on it. A lot of them, as we mentioned, took to the streets yesterday. They're not sure what to do right now. You'd think if there was any place a safe space would exist for them, it would be the Democratic National Convention, but not so. So what happens now?
I think resonating is an understatement. I would love to see a montage of all the weeping, crying faces as Bernie Sanders came out on the stage. It was amazing as the camera panned across the crowd, just the tears, the anguish, this weird combination of anguish and ecstasy as they saw their revolutionary leader. There's no question that Bernie Sanders forged quite a bond with his supporters. And there's also no question that his core supporters, at least, have very little love for Hillary Clinton. But I think over the long term of the race, a lot of those differences are going to be overblown because the core supporters of Bernie, the criers, the weepers, the chanters, are really a pretty small subset of the electorate, a really small subset of the electorate. Some polling I've seen says that 90% of Bernie voters are going to go ahead and back Hillary Clinton anyway. The Democrats are counting on that. I think it's one of the reasons why Hillary chose Tim Kaine. She knew that she didn't really have to choose a progressive or someone who's known as a progressive to be a running mate because all those Bernie supporters would fall in line anyway. Now, that is, of course, contingent, as I said earlier, that at some point on the notion that at some point in 2016, politics is going to kind of sort of revert to normal. If it does, Hillary has absolutely nothing to worry about. But if 2016 stays 2016, maybe she miscalculated with Tim Kaine. Maybe she miscalculated in her belief that Democratic Party unity would ultimately prevail. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the next few weeks and months. And I think one of the things that you may see is that she'll suffer from a turnout gap. Because it's one thing to say, I'm not going to oppose her. It's another thing to say, well, I'm going to go ahead and turn out and vote. She's going to depend on a pretty big turnout operation. And how much of these Bernie people are, I think very few are going to go to Donald Trump, but how many of them are just going to stay home? That's going to be an interesting question, because after all of the revolutionary fervor for Bernie Sanders, I sense exactly zero revolutionary fervor for Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton doesn't have the fervor, but as our exit question for the day, you know, back in 2008, critics of Barack Obama saw his supporters as seeing him as kind of in a messianic state. We just talked about how Bernie's supporters did that. Trump critics would probably say that about his supporters this year. How have we gotten to that point in American politics? We could probably take hours to discuss that, but what do you think is ultimately responsible for the rise of that?
Well, you know, I think it's what happens in some folks, Ross Douthat has been saying this, and I think some other smart observers are saying this. This is what happens when you begin to have post-Christian politics. It's people are still looking for meaning. People are still searching for meaning, even though we have declining levels of religious faith in this country. And they're fixing an awful lot of that meaning, at least in a subculture of America, around politicians, in much the same way that people fix a lot of their meaning around following sports teams now or following particular celebrities or becoming fanboys of sci-fi franchises. This is the meaning and the purpose in their lives. And you saw that with Barack Obama just to an excessive amount. And he, frankly, absolutely basked in it and fostered it and fed it. I mean, this is a guy who promised that this was, you know, his nomination and election marked the time when the seas stopped rising. So he stokes it. Donald Trump stokes it with his imagery and his larger than life persona. And in an era when people are looking for political messiahs, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton is vulnerable, because the last thing that she is right now is a political messiah. She's a Democratic political operative who is at this moment winning only because the Republicans nominated Donald Trump. That's the only reason she's in the driver's seat right now. And right now she's not even in much of a driver's seat. She's fallen behind in the Real Clear Politics polling average. But we'll see how that shakes out after both conventions.
Yeah, well, maybe a little reality will dawn on some of these young folks. And as you said earlier, they'll probably behave themselves during Hillary's speech, unless there's a Pokemon to catch up on stage, and then it's anybody's guess.
Then we'll see where their love truly lies.
Yes. David, it's been great having you the past few days. Thanks so much for filling in.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. David French of National Review in for Jim Garrity. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us, and please tune in again on Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.